artificial intelligent therapy. Say what? Intelligent therapy. Artificial therapy. Therapy that uses artificial intelligence. Or therapists using artificial intelligence to understand, perhaps, the notes that they've taken. Just where is the profession going? Today I'm joined by Meg Moss from the National Counselling and Psychotherapy Society and Rory Lees-Oakes from Counselling Tutor as we discuss how technology, including artificial intelligence, probably is changing the landscape of the future and just what we need to do in consideration of ethics, guidelines and more.
So where we're currently at is in a world where technology is in fastly increasing, changing, evolving. And just to date this, Gemini was released yesterday, and I don't know if you've seen any videos of the Gemini model, but yikes. What we call artificial general intelligence is on its way, but we're not there yet. And I know that both of you are involved in conversations around this particular topic. So what I'm going to do is come to Rory first in terms of what are you seeing in conversations from students? What are you seeing in your Facebook groups? What are you seeing overall as a whole in the space of psychotherapy, counselling, and the use of large language models, AI and bots?
Yeah, thank you, Kath. My name's Rory Lees-Oakes. I'm the Academic Director of Counselling Tutor, and we supply resources for both students and CPD for professional therapists that they take it online. We've taken a keen interest in AI or large language models because we see it as an opportunity and to some extent, a threat. What we're seeing through our Facebook group, we have 54,000 members in our Facebook group at the point of recording this, is that people are rather confused with AI. I think in terms of the students' experience, students aren't sure how to use it, maybe ethically. Mm-hmm. The temptation is to get AI to write my assignment and get AI answer questions, and of course, you know, in terms of academic integrity, that really isn't on, and already learning institutions are now training their staff in terms of CPD on detecting AI content. So I think there's a piece of work there in terms of how to ethically use AI if you're using it for your studies. Now, in terms of professional practitioners, AI databases are starting to pop up, and you know, maybe we'll get this in, discuss this as the conversation develops, but there are different models of AI. So there's what we call native AI, which is ChatGPT-4 or the latest iterations of that, because it's moving so quickly, which basically just scrapes the web and gives information. And then what we call vertical AI models. Now, vertical AI is where someone builds their own AI and populates it with relevant data, relevant research data. So the bot will only give answers that are researched and have relevant data. And in fact, Counselling Tutor has something called Lever, which is a virtual librarian assistant, which is trained on the resources in our library. And if you ask it a question, it will give you an overview and then point you to some resources. So a lot of confusion, I think, Kath, and also a little bit of excitement, because you know these models are now being developed, maybe in support functions, but the structure of that, I think, is still a little blurred.
Hugely. I'm just, oh my gosh, my head is buzzing with so many questions I want to ask right now in terms of where we go with this. What I'm thinking that might be useful for people who are going to listen to this is, so we've got the education stream that you've just talked about there in terms of ethical use of And yeah, I mean, the children I'm working with are using some of the AI models to write their essays and to do the research for them and to answer it in a tone, because you can completely change the tone of how something's written. So I think the education side of it sounds like a membership board discussion about what we need to do and how we can put out advice for this. So certainly the first question that's running through my head at the moment is what's happening at membership body level? And I think this is where I'm going to lean on Meg a minute. What's happening at membership body levels with the, dare I say, experts in this space? Because I'm not sure, and I don't know if this is the most diplomatic way to say this, I'm not sure entirely that we have people equipped at the high levels to be able to understand this. So I believe that you're doing something at NCPS, Meg. So did you want to kind of just tell us a little bit for the people listening, what NCPS are looking at doing, how that's coming to fruition, and literally how we stay on top of this?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think you're right in that we don't have the expertise in-house at the moment. No membership body does to deal with this in the best way possible. So what we're kind of doing now is we have joined an expert reference group, which was set up by the wonderful counselling tutor to look at together all of the challenges that we're facing as a profession, mm-hmm. to look at best practice,
yep.
to draw on our kind of collective experiences and some of the ethical implications that are coming up within the different professional bodies,
mm-hmm.
And sharing our learning from those. And one of the things we're all kind of talking about is, you know, we are trying to write policy around this for our members.
Yeah.
But things are changing so rapidly that you start writing a policy, and by the time you've got to the end of it, you almost have to start again.
Yes.
Because it's about getting the language around that to be broad enough to encompass any future changes, but also specific enough that it can actually deal with some of the issues that members are facing. And there's a lot of it, and it's already coming up, things like, you know, how members use AI in their practice. It can be from, you know, really directly like using these kind of native AI chatbots to support their clients while they're out of the office, mm-hmm. which obviously brings up huge huge questions there, to things like using AI for their admin and their notes and potentially, you know, putting their client notes into kind of ChatGPT for the notes to be rationalized better,
yeah.
And then the data implications for doing that as well, and there's so much that's coming up that as a professional body, as a group of people, we may not have expected members to do, but is happening. So and how do we then integrate that learning into what we're doing as well? And then the other side of this, you know, you talk about the education side where people are using like ChatGPT to write their essays. We also, a huge part of not just our like membership accreditation type processes involve writing a written statement, or for other organizations, mm-hmm. it's case studies. And how are we going to adapt as an organization to take into account that there's likely some of those that are going to be written using generative AI, and yeah. you know, we're going to have to change like fundamentally how we do that. And that's another conversation that's being had, not just by us but other professional bodies as well.
Indeed, right across the board. I know at the moment a lot of the students I'm working with are writing their, or did write some of their statements for university using some of these models. But there's something here about, I think, as a whole, and this is my interpretation, and this comes from 5 years of trying to talk to this profession about what we call Web 2.0 in terms of the problems, the issues, the dangers, the pitfalls, and the risks and processes that they need to engage in terms of looking after data, information about their clients. And what I've noticed across, particularly since the swear word GDPR became something that was, well, I think it still is a swear word, but there's certainly something about not necessarily understanding the technology. And I'm thinking what I should have done is written a book called Just Because We Can Doesn't Mean We Should. And I think that would have been a better title, because there is something about, so I work with a neuroscientist and have conversations about some AI models. And there are some AI bots that have been developed to kind of support people with a CBT type model. But what you're talking to there is similar to what I'm experiencing, where therapists might suggest using an app and not necessarily knowing or understanding what that app is, who it was designed by, what happens to the data, and it becomes quite a popular conversation. Now, I don't know if this is something you see, Rory, in terms of those conversations on the Facebook groups, because I and again, this is where Kath has learned over 5 years, that what generally happens is I will refer people to Orca and I will say, please use apps that have been viewed, they've really been investigated for their applicability, data protection, cybersecurity, and those are the ones that are given a percentage mark by Orca as to how applicable it could be for use in a therapeutic setting or outside. But what I am seeing is now this flurry of, well, they wouldn't have designed the technology if we weren't to use it. But the issue I've got, and it's not necessarily from the education section, I think it's more about what these models are being trained on is copyright material. So it was interesting when I asked ChatGPT a question. So it was ChatGPT-3, going back a while. I asked it a question about cyber trauma and it brought back all my material. All my material that's been written in books. Now, I didn't give anybody permission for that. Neither did the publisher. And yet on the surface, these organizations will tell you they are not being trained on material that is copyrighted. And that's a big fat fib. So if you think about material that's out there, that, I mean, this could end up being used and utilized. This actual conversation taken from YouTube, you know, mined, used for a particular purpose. And that is really, really scary when you think about what's being collected without that ethical extended thinking by a practitioner. So I'm wondering, what do you see, Rory, on the page in terms of recommendations from people or what they're doing? And are there things that make your toes curl in terms of what we need to catch up with?
Well, I think the first thing I'd say to that, Kath, is that in our Facebook group, there is an ongoing conversation about data protection. If we were to go back, say, to 2018, you know, pre the pandemic, there wasn't much of a conversation about data protection. In fact, I can safely say that in the profession, post-GDPR, there wasn't really, you know, pre-GDPR, there wasn't very much of a discussion about data protection. And then GDPR came into law in 2018. And again, you know, I made a lecture on data protection, and I have to say it was probably one of the least viewed lectures that we ever made. it's such a dry subject and a moving face that I just don't think, I think we were just too ahead of the curve. Now I think that this is all that's being discussed. And I think it's relevant to say at this point that, you know, the message that needs to get across to anybody using any app is that how much of you is the product? There's an old saying that if you get something for free on the internet, you are the product. And what that means is, is that they will use your data in ways to make them profitable. And you've already alluded to this, Kath.
With
the fact that your book is a copyrighted book. Yeah, it's quoted in AI models. And, you know, we don't know where the data is. And I've just done a piece of research on data and the data industry. And it's absolutely terrifying. It's probably one of the biggest industries in the world. We're talking billion-pound industries where you can go to a data organization and ask them, we had this conversation, Kath, tell me about Kath Nibs and apparently your data is worth £6.50 or something like that.
It's not even that much.
But it is frightening. And the other thing is, of course, with artificial intelligence, there's the time they're trained up to. So ChatGPT-4, I think, was trained up to 2022, which means that when you search it or use it, the information is only relevant to 2022. Now, I know that the latest iterations that are coming out will be more modern, but, you know, we'll take on more data. But I think the takeaways for me is from the group is that there's a lot of uncertainty around data protection in general, even to the point of should therapists register with the Information Commissioner's Office for UK-based therapists. That conversation's still ongoing.
For those listening, I just rolled my eyes.
The answer is you should. You know, if you're doing data, you should. You know, there's no debate, really. And also about how AI can be helpful. And, I've heard anecdotally there's a number of therapists who are using commercial software to produce therapy bots. We've done a beta therapy bot just for our own form. We're never going to release it. It was just as an experiment. And you can make them. You can train them up. Mm-hmm. And I think that the road to hell's paved with good intentions, as they say. And I'm sure that a lot of the issues that we're going to be seeing isn't therapists being malign and going out to disadvantage their clients. It's they're thinking, well, this is a good idea. I can help them. Mm-hmm. But without the underpinning knowledge of where that data is being stored, and also the big debate on, if you're training training a bot to be a therapist, what modality are you training? Where's the safety implications? Where are the safeguarding implications? It could be very, very difficult. And I think it's proved to be, ethical bodies, as Meg has alluded to, have already received complaints.
Well, I want to kind of name two things that have really come up for me when we've been talking. And one is that, as well as the ethical implications for choosing to use AI in whatever form, in terms of signposting onto a chatbot, providing an app to your clients, how are we really considering how that's affecting the therapeutic relationship? Is one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't think members. I don't. No one's. And two, to go on to that is, I'm going to be honest in that we haven't had a lot of questions about this. We haven't had a lot of engagement from members about this. No one's asking about the ethics. We're not hearing about it. People may be having these conversations elsewhere, but no one is coming to their professional body, by and large, to talk about this stuff and to understand it and the ethical implications of doing that. And why not? Is there a level almost of secrecy about using chatbots and about using AI is one thing that I'm wondering. You know, we're not talking about that we're using it because I don't know why. Maybe there's a level of not wanting to break that barrier or not wanting to be seen to be moving in that direction because you don't know how maybe your professional body is going to react, maybe your profession is going to react to it, something like that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But people aren't actually asking us about what we think about that. We're having to go out and, share that stuff. So I think that's really interesting as well, because people are definitely using it. They definitely are. And you see conversations, little pockets here and there, on things like LinkedIn about how therapists use AI. Yeah, but that's not really filtering through to that maybe the organization that can best help you with how to do that ethically.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
Go on, Rory.
I wonder if there's not a cognitive connection being made between the
That's,
use of
yeah.
AI and ethics. I get the sense sometimes that it's a separate thing, and I don't want to be too mean to people, but I think there's a naivety in general. In the general public, not just the therapeutic community, but the general public, about technology, that people use technology with no understanding of where that data is being stored, who's looking at it, and also the appropriateness of it, because I don't think that a lot of people have the educational and research background to be able to understand it. It's like when you start drilling in, like we're doing, that you can actually see that there's a lot more to this. What is on the face of it, a friendly, fast solution has a lot of ethical strings to it and a lot of ethical paths that need to be discussed. And those paths we've not walked down before. Let's be clear about this. We've not walked these paths before. So there's people haven't had those discussions. And this is, I guess, why we're here.
Yeah. So I'm going to use terminology which is in this data protection book, because one of the deficits that I've seen is in the profession of psychotherapy counseling, we tend to talk about ethics, and those ethics generally are about how we conduct ourselves, what that therapeutic alliance is, how we are in the room, what kind of person we are philosophically. What's been missing from the conversation way back when we first started to use computers and emails, and I noticed this in whenever it was I did a presentation for, I think it was PPS going back, which you can find online, and I actually talked to some professionals about email. Excuse me, and many people don't know how email works, let alone how technology is. And the bit that I noticed that seems to be missing from our profession is computer ethics and cyber ethics. Now, those two terms are disciplines within themselves. They have existed ever since the very first computer was built, and people started to look at the interaction between technology and the person. So I've got a little quote here from the book. Which is about technology and why cyber ethics. So this is from somebody called Spinello. We implicitly embrace the philosophy, of technological realism, which sees technology as a powerful agent for change and forward progress in society. But unlike more utopian views, this position does not ignore the dangers and deterministic tendencies of technology, along with its potential to cause harm and undermine basic human rights and values. Now, that was written in 2017 from the sixth edition of Computer Ethics and Cyber Ethics. Well, it was cyber ethics and philosophy. So what I think misses from our profession is the integration of other disciplines, and that has been absolutely quite clear from the outset that we don't have data protection as a discipline involved. We don't have information security discipline. And cybersecurity, information security, data protection, and privacy are their own disciplines outright. And they seem to be separate from everything that we're doing within the counseling and psychotherapy professions, because there's almost this thing about, yeah, but I'm using a computer. I'm not studying to use a computer or to integrate it into my practice. And I think it's not necessarily I don't know what word I want here. It's not a cognitive deficit. There's a misalignment between what I'm using and who I am in the therapy room versus the tools that I then use to help me engage and work with that client. So what would be your reflection then, Meg, in terms of that therapeutic alliance and what you think's interjecting if people do use technology?
I don't know that I'm really going to be the expert on that. I just have a sense that there's something there that as a profession we're not talking about. Kind of like you said, like you were saying, it's almost like it's not just about data protection, and it's not just about how we use the technology for the purposes of running a session or for the purposes of providing a session. It's that additional piece now when we're coming into using things like AI, it's like, what is this? How is this almost like this third person in the room now? And I, you know, this is just something that's come into my head as part of the conversation that we're having today. So I'm not going to pretend that I've done a lot of thinking about it, because I haven't. It's maybe like 5 minutes. I just think that we just need to do a little bit more talking about that. And I do really get it in terms of like therapists, members. Before the pandemic hit, nobody was working online, really. A small cohort of people were already doing that. And I remember conversations that we would have as an organisation in terms of online working. And it was always very kind of conservative in a way, with like, well, yes, you can work online, but really the preference is that you have face-to-face. And that all seems very, very old-fashioned now, thinking about that. But that was even 2019. We were still having conversations about that. It's really, you know, really should be face-to-face work. That's where the magic happens. And, you know, I really remember that. And so members were used to, you know, keeping their data on hard copies in filing cabinets. You know, people weren't maybe using, even, you know, even in 2019, probably weren't using computers to store data. You would have your client forms, they would fill them out by hand, and they would go into a filing cabinet, and you would lock that, and that would be in a locked room in your, wherever it was that you had your office. If it was at home, it would be your locked office, or if you worked somewhere, that would be in a locked room, and you had your data protection that looked like that. And I think people were, by and large, really comfortable with that. As you know, there has been a big sea change, and it is taking people a long time to kind of catch on. Like, actually, now that we're doing things electronically, there is more that I need to do. And I really understand that. You know, people through the pandemic, people were struggling with a load of other different things, but it really is the time now that we as a profession have to start getting it together. We should have been doing it before. We absolutely should have been. But I understand, but this, you know, we can't put off, as you know, as membership bodies supporting our members, and as members who hold data about clients, we can't put off any longer being conversant with this kind of stuff and taking the time to really understand it. And, you know, I see conversations in, you know, Facebook groups and stuff, the kind of therapy groups, like therapy subreddits and all that kind of thing, where people are talking about, you know, what platform do you use for that? What platform do you use for video conferencing? And people are still saying things like, oh, well, I use Google Meet because it's free and it's never let me down. And and then you have these kind of lone voices of people saying like, I don't want to say any kind of particular platform, right? But you know the ones that you would perhaps use, and it's they're really low down and no one's liking them or upvoting them or anything. But I want to see those become part, like really high up part of the discourse, and saying people go, oh yeah, more people saying, I use this because it's safe and my client's data is protected and my data is protected. And yeah, I know, you know, we've been talking about how we get there on this 4 years already. And we're, I guess we're still going to be talking about it, right? But I'm hoping that there will be some more movement on that.
And how do we
And
do
just to
it?
pick up, just to pick up from what Meg said, and I think just with you start to say, how do we do it? I think that professional bodies need to lead in some ways. Ethical frameworks and this construction of ethical frameworks should have consideration in terms of use of AI, use of technology, and that should be implicit within frameworks, because what will happen then is that will filter down not only into the profession for those who are qualified practitioners, but also into the conversations at training level. So, you know, one of the things that the piece that I think sometimes missed at training level is that a lot of training organizations that are awarding bodies are missing this piece completely, because it just doesn't get covered. I don't know what Ofqual has in terms of specification, in terms of talking about technology and therapy. So I think that profession is behind the curve in terms of discussing the ethical aspects of it. And we talked a lot about practitioners and bodies and organizations, but I wonder what client preferences are now that AI has passed the Turing test. I wonder what, as Roger's really well framed, the people of tomorrow will think about this, because both myself and Kath, we were child practitioners. I was a child practitioner for 7 years. I know you still are. And one of the lessons I learned very early on was that young people's adaptation to technology and how they form relationships were very, very different. You know, I taught many years ago with you, Kath, about the idea of corporeal relationships, where you're meeting, you know, face to face, and you can reach out and touch someone on the arm if that's appropriate. Where and also online relationships. And one of the things that we both identified was that with young people, I'm talking 10 years ago, was that border of corporeal and online was no differentiation. There's no differentiation
No,
at
no.
all. Whereas with people of our generation, we would have people we meet online, we say, well, they have online people, and people we meet in, you know, face to face, maybe in the supermarket or in the pub if you go to the pub, and they're the people we know. And I just wonder how a generation that has been brought up with technology, have engaged with AI, will actually consider AI when it comes to therapeutic intervention. I think there's a whole discussion and a whole piece of
Yes.
ethics yet to be discussed on that.
Well, my question was going to be, how do we do this without overwhelming people? But certainly, Rory, that and I'm going to say, actually, one of the things that I really applaud Counselling Tutor for is working with that early entry level coming in and having those conversations. So your space, your CPD area, as well as the lectures that you do, the podcasts, you're addressing issues that haven't been brought into that space. And I suspect there is this thing about, if the membership bodies are not sending it downward, then it's not being considered at the lower levels of training, because it's not necessarily understood. Again, because those practical and ethical implications are confusing, overwhelming. And what was running through my head was that conversation that we had at Manchester Institute that time, when I scared the living pants off the therapists about the GPS and the way that our phones track what we're doing. Now, that's going back many, many years. And all of those, let's call them, issues that relate to technology are scary. I understand that. I spend my time looking at how technology facilitates abuse in a lot of the clients I work with. But certainly, the younger people are coming in, and this is to your point, Rory, they will say to me, where do you keep my data? So I have a long conversation with my clients, and I think the responsibility lies with us to say to our clients, okay, so if I take notes, I'm sure people know by now, it's been said enough times, I do not, unless, of course, it's for court cases, et cetera, because that way I'm limiting the amount of data breaches and cybersecurity issues that come my way. And that is to protect a client. And it's my responsibility to explain what I use, why I use it, what the risks are, how I protect that data, and also their entitlement about that information. And that includes, I do not use AI models. I don't put any of our notes online. If you try to engage with me in the social media space, that's not going to happen. I do have a social media presence. So there might be times that clients look for me, but I will not look for them. So I have all those conversations right at the outset. And overall, and I'm just looking over the top of my PC here, I have all of the gaming stuff in my office because that's actually what I do. And I've used technology with my clients for a long, long time, biofeedback, gaming, and more recently, the VR stuff. And one of the things that I have conversations about is when you use this platform, it's my account that's signed in. So none of your data is captured. And also, I don't back these things up to the cloud if I don't know what that company does with that da-da-da-da-da. Now, I know that there's overwhelming information that comes out about technology, but there's also this overwhelming feeling that people will sometimes turn up to my training and then put it by the wayside. And, you know, during lockdown, I had a number of children's services that came to me and said, we want to do online. I talked to them about the law, the ethics, the way that children's data can be used against them. And some of them said, oh, but that means that we can't do what we want to. And I said, and ethically, that's the right responsible position to take. And some of those organizations ignored what I said. And I worry about those children and what Shoshana Zubrov calls capital surveillance. What is going to happen to them later on down the line? And then what will happen to our profession when all of those claims begin to go in saying, you didn't protect my data, I now can't get a loan, I can't get a mortgage, my healthcare insurance has been revoked, da 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 da, and so on and so on and so on. Because that's the high end level. And for me, there's something about our profession, and I repeatedly say this, holds the most sacrosanct information. And we seem to be the least qualified to protect that information, which is that disconnect is about how do we have those conversations. And I suspect, Meg, that's what you're alluding to in terms of the like the membership, and Rory, you talking about the membership bodies. How do we have these conversations over something that is incredibly boring? There's no way around it. It's incredibly boring to read terms and conditions. It's incredibly boring to sit and write a privacy policy that covers every aspect of your practice. And that's where I think ChatGPT is being utilized, is people saying, well, I don't need to learn it. I can use evolving technology to create da 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 da. And there is actually a discipline that's, I'm just thinking here, there is a discipline that started a while ago, and it's all about the neuro rights of people. So, you know, what happens if AI collects data on somebody's psychological profile? What do we do then? Question mark.
I mean, the concern is, of course, is that this is a jigsaw puzzle. That it's not easy to see the whole picture by looking at the individual pieces. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I had a conversation with a colleague who was very concerned about the fact she was a child therapist. She worked for a school, and the school's policy was that they used a platform, video platform, well-known video platform, and the policy was that every single conversation was recorded and stored to their cloud, and that would include meetings with students. Yes, I know. And in terms of therapy, and I said it's just not on. I said, where is the due diligence here? And, you know, the conversation always comes about, well, we've run it past the data protection officer and they're fine with it. And I said, yes, they're probably fine with it because they're looking through one particular optic. I said, they're not looking through the optic of, as you've said, that sacrosanct information that children have. Now, that was one piece of the jigsaw puzzle. So let's just say, for instance, that those organisations that took no notice of you have gone down the route of recording a client's information and it's stored on the cloud and it's just stored. What we don't know is what access AI has to that cloud. We already know it's busted your data, your copyright, because it's quoting your book. So what else is it scraping from? Where, you know, the organizations are very secretive about what they do with this data. So I had a conversation with a neighbor the other day, just off the cuff conversation about what's your day like, what you're doing, Lorraine. He's a web developer. And he told me he worked for, shall we say, a well-known company. I'll leave it at that. And that well-known company provides training courses. We'll leave it there. Another arm of that company used the information they got to scrape data and sold the data. And they made millions in the sale of data. They made millions in the sale of data. And what we could see as this picture emerges is that child goes and talks about their issues, that information stored, it's scraped and sold. And as you say, when they come to get a mortgage or they come to get a job, that then becomes part of the inventory of their life that then can be accessed by anybody. Yep. Absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. In cybersecurity circles, the phrase data is the new oil is the one that's shared at nearly every presentation and every meeting I've been to. What's scary for me is protecting it. So I'm just thinking about a survey that I was invited to take part of the other day, which is helping protect people who are disclosing sexual abuse and how we can protect our notes from the judicial system. So I'm quite robust in this area and don't hand over anything until a judge has asked for it, pretty much, because everything that I do is about my client and my clients, the space I offer them. And I know this word gets confused so often, and this is what led to a miscommunication in lockdown with a number of people, the word safe. So there is a piece of research where myself and two other professors talked about when we offer a safe space for our client, we have these innate understandings about what safe looks like. So we have a room. So I'm sitting here in my therapy office. I, for the first time at the minute, I've got the computer in here because I wanted to sit down on the sofa today. And also my office is a mess at the minute, so I don't want people seeing that background. So there is something about in this room. The computer does not come in here unless I'm doing something like this. But in this room, there are no listening devices. There are no cameras. I have blinds and net curtains, and there's a door that shuts. And I'm in a building where I can say to my clients, this is a safe space. And what we actually do is we leave our devices in my office. So everybody leaves their things outside the room so that nothing can be captured within this space. And when we talk about safe spaces and we start to think about technology, there is no such thing. So for those young people who want to be able to talk to a therapist and disclose some of the most heinous things that have ever happened and their worries, their fears, their dreams, that whatever it is. And for adults, it obviously includes a lot more than that. They're discussing perpetrators. They're discussing third persons. They're discussing, you know, their parents. If technology is capturing all that information, it also has a ripple effect. It isn't just the child that we're thinking about. And for me, this is why it's so important, because we're not thinking about the person standing in the room. We're thinking about, you know, if you think of Bronfenbrenner's circles of social engagement, you've got the close family. Well, what happens if that child is adopted, or the child doesn't have those same circles that a standard nuclear family 2.4 children has? What are we doing to protect those children in those spaces? For example, I used to go into residential settings and they would ask me to conduct the therapy in the living room with a smart TV, with a fire stick in the back of it, child holding the technology. Not a chance. Wasn't going to happen. And I think because I have worked in technology, I have that thinking pattern that would say, well, how are you protecting this child? What are you doing to da 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 da? And of course, my last 12 years of working with children has been how technology has been used to exploit them. or how technology has captured something about them, or how technology was misused, etc., etc., etc. And I'm wondering, how do we even have those conversations? Because CAFNIBS is becoming a pain in the backside to a large number of people in this profession, because she keeps speaking out about this and saying, you haven't considered that, and you haven't considered that, and why are we doing this? And, you know, just because we can doesn't mean we should. So how do we even do that?
That's just such an important question, and I wish that I had the answer, because that's a really big part of what my job is how do we engage hearts and minds to really make a difference on this? And that's just part of the challenge, that, you know, that's it's not something that is kind of new to us. Like, we have already tried various different ways to get members engaged with this conversation. Nothing has really worked so far, so we need to be more creative and think about how we do that. And I think, you know, the conversation about getting in at that first qualifying training level, so engaging mm-hmm. training providers, is going to be really important. But that only captures people in the future who will be counsellors and psychotherapists, who, you know, potentially some of those will be of a younger generation who will be more conversant around this stuff anyway, not necessarily, because, you know, you don't always go into counselling as a profession straight from school. But how do we reach the people that are already doing this job and will be doing this for the next 20, 30, 40 years, perhaps, who aren't engaging with this stuff? And it is a huge, huge challenge. And yes, we can update our code of ethics. And that is actually a project that is coming up. So we will make sure that that is kind of more integrated for the NCPS. But we are not the biggest professional body. And how do we just kind of amplify these kind of conversations that we're having, make them more accessible to people who are scared of this conversation? And I don't have an answer right now, but it's definitely something that I think about quite a lot, and how to really engage that. And if we can get that, if we can figure that out, then once people are actually thinking about it and having these conversations, it's not as hard and scary as people think it's going to be.
No.
You just need to take a little bit of time to really just sit down and understand it and engage with it. But yeah, that is the big question.
It seems to me we're at the same point we were maybe 20 years ago with EDI, equality, diversity and inclusion, where, you know, people are having the same challenges in terms of, you know, I'm afraid of saying anything in case I get it wrong, or maybe it doesn't include me. And I think, you know, certainly in all my professional conversations with colleagues, it comes up in the conversation. And I think that, like with EDI, where that's an ongoing conversation for therapists. You know, there's not a conversation I have with a therapist nowadays where we don't talk about, you know, diversity, equality, diversity, and inclusion. You know, my latest conversations about, you know, neurodivergence, and that's become, you know, quite a big conversation piece. I mean, obviously, there's equally and as important areas of diversity to be discussed. But I think it's getting it into our conversations. I think that as therapists, we need to, you know, have that top of mind, in the top of our mind, and discuss it and say, you know, and we have a duty of candor as therapists. So I think sometimes we forget this. We can have those, you know, critical, friendly conversations with colleagues where, you know, I've said, you know, I'm a bit direct. You're storing your client data where? No, don't do that. And these are the reasons. And you're amplifying those and then educating the next person along, help supporting the next therapist along, who can then go on to support the next therapist along. And also, I think, you know, the training programs. And I also think there's a conversation now starting in wider society. You know, we are seeing programs on the TV, we're seeing podcasts, we're seeing, in, you know, certainly pieces in the legacy media about data. I think it's becoming, I think awareness is raising, but keeping it in our conversations. And I think with our help with friends in ethical bodies, to have ethical protocols around it, it'll be mightily helpful.
Absolutely. And I am just going to make, before we come to an end today, I just want to ensure that I actually say something, which when I'm doing my training, I'm kind of putting pieces together for people and, you know, making links between, for example, I don't know, do you have your email on your phone? Have you considered that your email then backs up to iCloud? Therefore, what you're actually doing is that it's usually a penny dropping moment for people going, oh, I hadn't made those connections. But I will certainly say I have a long career in front of me teaching and educating every single profession, not just therapists and counsellors. So the consultations that I'm involved with at the moment are going into the spaces of all of the different kinds of businesses. So I just want to make it kind of very clear at the end. This isn't just therapists that are dealing with this issue. This is all of us. You know, we've been slam dunked into the basket of AI and what's evolving. And, you know, just to quote Elon Musk here, I do agree with him that AI is the far most incredible technology, but it comes with a whole heap of harms that none of us are able to predict. But certainly, we are the profession who has the highest, to talk to what you were talking about there, Rory, candor, we have the highest level of responsibility to our clients because of what we do as a profession. And I often make the reflection, banks take a lot of time and spend a lot of money protecting our data. And that's mostly about the money that we earn, the money that we have. So if banks are doing that, could we as a profession literally put ourselves on a higher pedestal that we need to do more than banks, casinos, etc., etc.? Because what we hold is more valuable. But also being aware that when we have conversations with EAP services, when we have conversations with social care, my weekly gripe is replying back to large organisations, local authorities, certainly social care, that do not protect data. And it's our responsibility sometimes to educate the people we're working with in, if I'm taking care of this data, you have to as well. So it's to say that it's not just us. Let me tell you, there are, I mean, Social Care Direct, just as an example, have all had GDPR training according to any model that you read, because everybody has to use particular services. And yet what happens is people on the move get something in their head and it's like, oh, I've got to email Kath about little Billy, so I'll just pick up my phone and I'll send her a quick email. Rather than taking that moment to think, technology makes things so easy, but it's that easy route that can cause and be a damaging factor. And for me, the most damaging factor is if that data is then shared, what will that person do? And the most dangerous thing I can think of is a person ending their lives because of something somebody didn't know and didn't do or didn't take the time to think about.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, you know, in summary, we're really at the beginning of this journey. We really, really are at the beginning of this journey. And by, you know, everybody engaging, I mean, you know, Meg, you know, from the ethical professional body side, from yourself in the educational field, I guess ourselves, and just keeping it in our conversations and just keeping it at the top of mind. Hopefully it will filter in. And I'm afraid that probably the biggest learning will come from when there is a data breach and some a client is has become disadvantaged, and it becomes more in the mainstream media, that that will be the lesson learned. I fear that the biggest lesson will be when someone is disadvantaged and damaged by a failure to protect data, and you know, through the use of AI, that will probably be the thing. And I also think that the government has a role here. You know, I've already seen the AI summit and talking about legislating for AI. I think we'll have to see how that goes. I think, you know, I think it's a mightily honourable move to do that, because I think they missed the boat with social media, quite frankly.
Yep. actually, Rory, it's evident that when something has gone wrong, then we create the legislation and laws, and we've got that with the Online Safety Act. And sadly, the Online Safety Act is 27 years too late. But like you said, it's at the beginning. It is in place, and now we can do things slightly differently. We don't have the equivalent for what we do or what we're talking about here, yet.
Absolutely.
So I want to thank you both for your time, and certainly Meg for raising some of those questions, which I'm now spinning around going, oh my gosh, I think there's another book here, or training, or podcast, or it's a really, really good point. But certainly I know that at the NCPS you have particular training that people could go and do in terms of first understanding the basics of data protection. But certainly as an organisation, and it's one of the things that I am really proud to say that I'm a member of NCPS for, is because of the way that you're addressing the issues around technology and have been. And obviously you've been having conversations with Gary Hibbard and I for five years now in terms of conversations. And certainly, I wanted to thank you, Rory, for doing what you're doing at Counselling Tutor, which is bringing those conversations to the early entry level, because that's where some of the mistakes are being made, not through anything other than naivety, non-knowledge, knowledge gaps, whatever we want to call it. And this is something that needs to happen top down, bottom up.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that those conversations aren't just at student level. They were also our qualified colleagues who use our CPD services. You know, and you know, one of the phrases that we've coined this year is ethical sustainable practice. You know, and part of being ethical is the use of AI. And I'd like to thank you, Kath, for being that pain in the bottom, because you know, as anybody who's done any kind of training therapy, we know there's no growth without pain, and maybe that pain is the vitamin that we need, the profession needs to progress and to grasp this very complex and very difficult area of human development.
I think there is a lot of work ahead of us. There is a lot of work, and especially talking for me now as someone who is responsible for policy and looking at all of that stuff, it's going to be a huge job for me. But I think it's one of the it's the most important thing that I'm going to have to be looking at. And constantly staying on top of. And I'm kind of weirdly excited about doing that work. Is that a weird thing to say?
No, that's where, you see, this is where the passion is. I know that you and I have talked about our geekiness in terms of technology. I think it needs people who are excited by this. So no, I don't think it. Because that would put me in the same boat. So that's what I'm saying there, really, isn't it? I'm just doing it egocentrically.
But I am. No, you know what? I am. I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into that, and like, you know, seeing how, obviously, you know, we can put the policy in place. We can put the ethical kind of underpinning in place. But there's also that other bit that is going to be another big job for us, is how do we get people really engaged with that? And I know it's a big job, but we are going to tackle it. And with the support of people like you, people like Gary, Kath, people like Rory, and colleagues in other professional bodies, there's so much we can do, we need to do. So watch this space. Maybe next time we have a conversation, we'll be able to talk about policy and ethics that are actually in place. And
So it's not kind of fingers crossed. It's going to happen. It has to happen. And thank you both for spending the time with me to discuss it so that we can have this conversation and, you know, put it out. What a Christmas present people are going to have.
Oh, yes. Yes. Good. Merry Christmas. Merry. I was trying to make it technology.
That's...
I wanted a pun, but I couldn't think of it.
Happy Muskmas, possibly.
Thank you.
Thanks.